Mr. Henderson, Reel 6. We're talking about time communications, Mr. Henderson. You were talking about netting. Can you go on with that?
Yes, we've already netted into one, and you had a switch with two positions, red and blue. On the switch was a red dot and a blue dot. You'd netted in on the red dot for a frequency. You went over onto the blue and you netted in again. And while you're talking, probably on blue, you'll get a word that had been said, a buttercup or whatever it was. You went straight over onto the other net. This was to confuse anyone that may be listening in. If you thought the enemy were listening in or it was something important that was coming up, you went straight onto the other net. And that was to confuse anyone.
And that was the purpose of the two nets?
That was the purpose of the two nets.
So you can move between the
two
in case you're being...
A buttercup now.
And that would be a code name.
That was a code name. It could have been anything. They used to say that you could understand another person's sending of one had his own signature tuned sort of thing when they sent most. I never found that. I suppose... It's possible, but I would think you'd have to be professionals and like on the Queen Mary or the Queen Elizabeth and doing it every day and all day, I think. We never found that, you know. We just read Morse as it was.
So if an infantry unit, say, was working with
yes.
the tank itself, and they wanted to talk to the tank commander, did they just rattle on the tank?
Yes. There was...
We
hadn't netted into any infantry. We hadn't netted in. This is what we're talking about. On Mont Pincon, for instance, we were with the infantry there, the Wiltshires. We had no communication, whatever. We were in front of them, you know. They came up behind us.
Some tanks had a telephone on the back that infantry commander could pick up and talk through to the... Tank
yeah.
commander. Did you not have that?
We didn't have that, no. We just had the 19 sets, and you could net, which you had to net in. You had to tune into, to each other. So you were all tuned in on the same wavelength. There may have been, the infantry might have been netted into to the regimental HQ. Which would relay the message to us. That's the only way which it would be done. He would get on to either brigade HQ or regimental HQ, and that the message would be passed on to us. But not individually, you know. Well, I mean, if the soldiers knocked on the tank and said, I want you over there, if everybody did that to every tank, you wouldn't know where you were. It had to be sort of organised, you know.
So you did the signalling, this radio work. What else did you do at Stainton?
At Stainton we had the wireless. Now this was very, very good. And while I'm talking about the wireless corporal, who I said was a very, very nice chap, a gentleman Welshman, and...
Do you remember his name?
I can't remember his name. I've tried to think of his name, but can't remember his name. He said to me, where are you from? This was just as I'd got down to Stainton. I said, I'm from Barnard Castle. He said, why don't you put in for a sleeping out pass? I said, well, I'm not married. You had to be married to get a sleeping out pass. But you can always try, he said. So he wrote, you have to write these applications out in a special way. Sir, I submit this, my application for sleeping out pass, etc., etc. He wrote this out for me, and I had to see the chief instructor, who was all dressed in black, blackberry, black denims, black belt, black gaiters, black boots. And a very, very strict major. Very, very strict man. And I marched into his office in the morning at 9 o'clock in my best battle dress and all done up and saluted as I went in. And he said, he had my application in front of him and he said, now who's this woman that you've got on with in the town? Or words to that effect. And I said, no, it's no woman, it's my mother. I live in Barnard Castle. My father's on active service in Norway. I think he was in Norway at that particular time.
He'd be his stepfather.
My stepfather. And my mother's at home with five children. I thought I might be of some assistance. And he just, without any more ado, he just stamped me pass, and that was it. Now, the pass that I had to be in for 7:30 in the morning. First parade of PT was at 7:25. So it meant that I came in straight into the, on my bicycle, straight to the cookhouse for my breakfast, and watched them all going out on the, galloping along on PT, and stayed in there. I didn't even have a hut. I used to put my bicycle in the ablutions of the boiler house and until evening, and then ride home on it. So I didn't do any fire pickets, and I didn't do any guards, because the guards were picked out of each hut, and so were the fire pickets. So I wasn't in a hut. So I was lucky there, in a sense. I missed the comradeship of the lads in the evenings, but at the same time, it was nice to be home, in a way. Other things we did at Stainton were driving. Now, everyone that was there had to learn to drive a soft vehicle, which is a lorry or a car. So we'd go out on a small 1500 weight to learn to drive. And the corporal, we had 2 weeks on this, two weeks to learn to drive. And the other chap that was with me was also a driver prior to joining the army. So when the corporal saw us driving, he said, "Right, change over." And the other chap had a driver. He said, "You're both better drivers than I am." And he lived in Newcastle, or Gateshead. So we used to drive to his house every day, walk round Gateshead till a set time, 2:30 or whatever it was, and then go back to his house and drive back to the camp. That was for a fortnight. We robbed ourselves there, because we liked driving, and if we hadn't been so good, we would have got more chance to drive. After that, we went on to driving radio and driving. One chap did the driving, and the other chap was in the back, operating a 19 set. So that was to further your driving skills and to do your radio as well, talking to each other in the different things. That was very, very good, very interesting. I'm sorry for these young people today that don't get the chance to do this, because it was a very exciting... It was like a big game. It was just like a game. So we did that, and then we got onto the half-track, the small tracked vehicles. That was the little Ben Gunn carriers. Just a day or something like that, just to get us the feel of the sliding on the tracks. And then we got into these tanks, which were Covenanters. And we went out onto the moors. Also, one in the back doing the radio, and the other one in the front doing the driving. And that's how it was killing two birds, using one vehicle to train two people.
These were just two crew in this
tank? No, we had four. We had a crew commander, we had another driver in the front. There was two drivers. There was the learner driver, and there had to be another one, sort of a driving instructor. And then there was the crew commander and the radio operator, it was really a five-man crew teaching us. They were RTR men.
Can you take me through that training of driving a vehicle of this nature for the first time?
For the first time, this is something we'd been looking forward to, and your heart was in your mouth. And you got in the... You'd taken it round the car park. It wasn't the first time you'd driven it, because the car park, the tank parks, are still there today, and they're big, and they're all concrete. And we'd done the skid turns on there, and we'd learn all about the skid turns, which was a matter of... You had two big tiller bars, two levers in front of you. When you pulled the right-hand lever, a short way back, you engaged an eight-inch brake shoe. When you pulled it a bit further, you went onto a bigger brake shoe, a 12-inch, and when you pulled it right back, you went onto a 15-inch brake drum, but you also had to change down, otherwise you'd stall your engine. It's like putting your brakes on in the car. So to do a skid turn, you had to rev up, change right down into bottom gear to do a skid turn, pull your stick right back, and rev right up to get round the corner. You had to drive it round. You just didn't pull the stick, otherwise you stalled your engine, which a lot of the lads did at first. You had to be prepared to use your gears. Even for the minor turn, you were, you know, a medium turn. You had to get down one gear. When you were going along the road at, say, 30 mile an hour, you didn't change down every time you come to a small bend. But for a good turn, you had to change down.
How many gears did the...
There's just four. It was just the four gears. And then we get to the... They were old-fashioned in those. Everything had four gears in them days. And then, finally, to go out on the road. And we had to go down the bank at Barnard Castle and over the stone bridge. That bridge, that small edge of the bridge, was all concreted, to save the tarmac on the roads. And then you went up onto the moors, onto Battle Hill, and your Cotherstone Moor and up on there. It was wonderful, you know. And then you maybe drove to dinner time, and then you always had what we called have a bag rations. There were haversack rations, and it was always four slices of bread, two slices of cheese, probably, and two slices with corned beef in between. We had no flasks or anything. So I don't know what we had to drink, unless there must have been something to drink. Probably they had the big communal flasks, probably in the back of the tank. I can't remember, but we did have the haversack rations, which was collected each morning for the crew, and you had those at lunchtime. And then you changed over. You went in onto the radio, and the other lad came onto the driving. I liked the driving better than the radio, because you saw more. When you were sitting in the bank in the turret, it was just like a round box. You couldn't see what was going on or where you were or anything, and you didn't have to be what to call it in close spaces. You couldn't be claustrophobic, not in the tank. You could never have done it. You would have gone mad. So we had the tank driving.
What can you describe the tank itself? This trainee tank was it very big?
It was a medium heavy Covenanter. It had a 12 cylinder engine, two banks of six with a crankshaft down the middle. The engine was made by, it was a Meadows engine. We also had Valentines. They also had a six, and that was a Liberty engine made by Nuffield, by the Morris Motor Company in Oxford. They were very good engines. They were petrol, all petrol. We didn't know an awful lot about them. As far as maintenance was concerned, all we learned at this particular time was driving them, and then we went on the maintenance, which was mostly to grease. There was also a task system, which was in a rotation. Day one might be changing the petrol filters. Day two was something else, you know. Until you got back to number one again. And if ever you were stopped by an officer or a sergeant major and said, what's the task for today? If you didn't know what it was, even when you joined the regiment, this went right through the army, this was an army, you had to know exactly. If you didn't know, you didn't say, I'm sorry, sir, I don't know. You gave him number five, sir, and hoped that it was. And if it wasn't, it hoped that he didn't know that it was number five, which he didn't, of course. He never did. So you always bluffed your way through.
Was there a driver's hatch as against the main hatch?
Yes, there was two hatches for the driver. Our British tanks, of course, were right-hand drive. So you sat at the right, like a normal vehicle. There was two hatches to get in. And then there was another hatch for the three crew in the back. The gunner, the operator, and the commander got in the turret at the back, and you were sitting at the front. And of course the turret went round, spun round and round. But you didn't. You were sort of stationary. That was a thing that was in the middle, that was on a rotation. A turret rotated from in a 70 in a complete 360 degrees in 7 seconds. That was on the power spin.
Was this a hydraulic power?
It was hydraulic on British tanks. We're all hydraulic. The American tanks were all electric. And the only snag with the hydraulic thing was that when you came round with the gunner spun round to go onto target and stopped, with it being hydraulic, it crept. It had a little bit of creep. You had to wind it back on the hand to get back onto target. When you stopped with electric, it stopped and it stayed there. To learn to the guns, as I said, we had 3 days with in the gunnery wing. I think it was three days, and there was a tank turret on rollers. When you sat in there, it was just like sitting in a tank turret, but it was just a turret on rollers, and you got the feel that you were in a tank, and just exactly, you wouldn't tell the difference. And the gun was an ordinary gun, but on the top of it was an air rifle. And so when you lined up your sights, which was a crossed wire through your periscope, and onto your little target, which was small tanks on a sand bed in front, and someone was winding a little wheel, and the tank was going across in front of you, and someone else was turning a little wheel, and the tank was going back. And as these little tanks were moving on this sandbed in front of it, it looked like we were training for the desert. This is called a RIPER. I don't know what RYPER, but it was a RIPER range. Don't know what the letter stands for. Forget now. And everyone, there was a queue outside. You only had 10 minutes on this, and it was a game. This was marvellous. The kids would love one of these for Christmas, but you only had 10 minutes, and there was always a queue when you had to be in and out. I think you only ever got in there once, but you could turn the turret, you could move around onto your target, and you could line it up on your little tanks, and you'd pull it and you'd see the tank fall over, and you knew it hit it. And as I say, we were training for the desert, because at that time the war was in the desert, and we expected to go straight from there to join our regiments, probably in the 11th Army Division, in the 8th Army. We could have done, some of them did. But that was how we learned to operate the guns. Fascinating.
And then, did you get the opportunity of firing the guns on the range?
We never fired the guns, but we did load. We did get a chance to load with empty shells, you know, with the blanks, and that was not very nice, because you were the wireless operator. When he's not operating his wireless, the gunner's sitting in his little seat with his eye on his periscope. And the crew commander maybe have his head out the window, out the top of the turret, probably or through his periscope. He had a periscope which looked out the top, but you couldn't see very much. The driver also had a periscope, but you couldn't see much. And so while the gunner was operating and turning round onto his target, the wireless operator had to load the gun. And you lifted a segment out of the floor, and the shells were underneath, like an orange, segments of an orange, and you took a shell out, and you pushed it up with your hand, pushed it in into the breech, and the breech come up. And if you didn't get your fingers out, it, as soon as it went over this little lip, it knocked it down, and the breech came up, and you had to, if you'd got it like that, you'd have got caught. You had to do it like that, and then. There was a canvas bag attached to it, and after you'd fired it, it opened, and the empty shell, the brass thing, went into the empty sack, and then you put another one in. And when you'd gone round the local segments, the other segments you couldn't get at them without turning your turret round. So unless the driver turned the tank round, so you could get the. So it turned the bottom half of the tracks round, leaving the turret where it was, facing the target. It meant that you were bringing the shells round into line of the open segment. You'd get more shells out. That was the only problem. In the later models, in the American tanks, in the Shermans, because it wasn't like they weren't under the floor, they were in boxes, like little cupboards at the side of the tank, which you got out. You didn't have that problem.
And you were basically just being taught to use a gun if it ever occurred, you know, if that occasion ever came.
Yes.
You weren't a gunner as such.
Well, I wasn't a gunner, but there wasn't a lot to it. You know, you could have fired the gun, and you could have, every time it was fired, every night the guns were cleaned out with a cleaning rod. You know, with a, you've seen these things with a lump on, and it goes through, and you clean. A couple of the lads are on a pole, clean it out. And each night in action, your boxes were filled, refilled with tank, with shells, and with fuel. But there wasn't an awful lot to learn about the guns, really. Mostly to learn was different kinds of ammo, which we didn't really learn about. There was different ammunition to put in the guns, which that didn't concern us very much.
Well, you're in a situation that you could take over.
Oh, absolutely.
Place within the tank itself.
Absolutely. Any position. We were a driver, and we were driver operator. We were equal in both driving and operating. We could interchange any time. And another thing was that the wireless operator had to be in, on most nights in action, on wireless watch. So he had to stop in his turret while the lads were asleep with his earphones on in case there was a message came through the night. So to give him a rest, the driver could change over with him and take the message.
You mentioned that the driver had a periscope.
Yes.
Yeah, so in action situation, you'll be closed down, presumably, and looking through your periscope.
That's right.
What could you see through that?
It was just a slit. It was just a little slit. You could see the vision, not very much, really. I don't know what degrees that would be. It was just to your centre and a little bit to each side. Very little. So most of the lads had the... You could pump your seat up, you know, and you could put your head out, look. And most of the lads had the... And the crew commander always had his head out. You couldn't see anything. You know, you were safer that way.
A bit dangerous in action.
Yes, but, I mean... one of you had to have his head out. If he had his head out, he could give you instructions. Driver left, driver right, and things like that. If it was possible to do that, if you were in a field, he could say, driver left, driver right. But if you were on a very narrow road, it's not easy to drive by somebody telling you. You've got to see it to drive it. You know, there's cases when you had to be. When you had to have your head out.
Can we finish the driving element? You talk about the two levers that you use.
Yes.
Changing the...
Yes.
Putting the brakes and what have you. What was the foot action? Did you have a clutch?
Well, you had to have a clutch to change the gear and an accelerator.
And they were the usual type of... larger type of car clutch? Or?
They were a big pedal, like on a heavy lorry. But to use your brakes, you just pull both sticks back. And that was it, and stand it on its nose. We just put the tank up on its nose, if you know, really. Pull it hard back. Those were the Covenanters, Crusaders, Valentines, Christies, all those were the same. Might have a different size brake shoes, the brake drums, you know. But on the Churchill was a different thing. It was something built on the same lines as the old First World War tank, where each track was worked individually by a crew there changing gear on that track and another crew changing gear on this track to get it to steer. That's how it was done on those first big old-fashioned tanks. The Churchills are the same. They had two gearboxes, one for each track. And they said that... My instructor said, don't ask me about it, because the man that designed them went mad. So he said, I could just give you a brief outline of a Churchill, but that's all I can tell you.
This Covenant tank, was it a tank that had been used in action, or was it merely training?
Oh, it was been used in action. In its day, it was quite a good tank. The Covenant had four big bogey wheels, the four big bogey wheels. And then there was the Crusader with the five. Now, the Crusader... was a very good British tank. It was one of our best tanks at that time. I think it was the best tank we had was a Crusader. And all our tanks, of course, had C: Churchill, Christie, Crusader, Covenanter, Comet, Challenger, they all have seas from the Cambria when the tanks first went into action in 1917. The Valentine didn't, I don't know why, but all the others all have they all start with C.
What was the armour like on the Covenanter that you were training with? How thick was it?
No, I can't remember. Somewhere about 5 inches, I would think, on the front. The front of the turret was the most armoured part. The rest, of course, didn't matter. The poor drivers didn't matter. But the front of the turret was the most armoured, heavily armoured. And I would think it would be somewhere about 5 or 6 inches on the front there. I'm only guessing on this. I don't know exactly what the armament was. But they were pretty well armoured on the front. They were a fighting tank, medium heavy.
And part of your training would be to learn about every aspect about that tank, presumably.
Yes, but we only had... I think if you learned one more... if you learned about driving a tank and operating a gun, I think once you'd got it in, you covered all the tanks. They were all different. Even two Covenanters would be different to drive. They only had a 6-pounder gun on a Covenanter, which was big. Previously, that they only had a 2-pounder gun on. The Churchill at first only had a 2-pounder. It was a heavy tank in the desert using a 2-pounder gun. It was like they were like pea shooters. And it wasn't until we got the Shermans that we had any kind of decent firepower at all. That was a 75mm. And then we put our own guns on, a 17-pounder, which put us on par with the Germans. But until then, we were well out. They could hit us long before we got anywhere near them.
How were you organised at Stainton Camp? Presumably you were now in the terminology of the tank corps, not the infantry platoon or squad.
We were into squadrons.
What constitutes a squadron?
A squadron constitutes five troops of tanks. And a troop of tanks is five tanks. So you've got 25 tanks to a squadron in the training regiments. That's what it was at Barnard Castle.
And you were assigned a troop?
So you got into a troop.
Did you call your troop at Barnard Castle?
I don't know that we were assigned a troop, because we're in classes. We were sort of at individual tanks. You could go into any tank, which tank was vacant, or which instructor was going to take you. You went with certain instructors, and when you land up in the morning, you go with Mr. So-and-so, or you go with Corporal So-and-so, or Corporal Murray will take you. And this is how you went on. You were given a tank to get into, and you went there like a lot of sheep and told which one to get into. You went when you got to the regiment, you were in a troop. You were in B Squadron, 3rd Troop. You knew exactly where you were. But not in the training regiments, because you were in different classes.
Well, your classes, as you've said, went round the various aspects of tank work.
Yes.
And you came back to the beginning and presumably started around again. Was that the process?
That's right. But when you were on the wireless wing, you might do all morning in the classroom. And then in the afternoon, you might go out with a tank or with a small four-wheeler doing wireless and a little bit of driving. And everybody had to pass out. Everybody had to pass out on the driving, on the four-wheelers, on the soft vehicles. Everybody had to have the driving licence in the armoured corps.